Good evening, everybody.
Hello and welcome to Disney Magic Hour, episode number 106. On this week's show, it is part 5 of our great movie ride film series. This week's film is Alien. Joining me all via Skype, starting clockwise, I'll do it that way, is none other than Courtney Van Ren. Say hello, Courtney.
Hello, Courtney.
From the great state of New York is Brian Bogad. Say hello, Brian.
Hello, Brian.
From the middle of the woods, I assume, of the Main Street Gazette is Ryan Wilson. Say hello, Ryan.
Hello, Ryan.
And joining us for the couple of times, I don't know the exact number, is Mr. Adam Corbett. Say hello, Adam.
Hello, Adam.
Hello, Pete. And say hello, Pogo. This episode of Disney Magic Hour is brought to you by MEI Travel. For all your vacation planning needs, for visiting Walt Disney World, taking a cruise anywhere, maybe even to space, or traveling anywhere around the globe, visit the experts over at meitravel.com, where Becky and her team can get you started on your own adventure. Right now, you are listening to There You Are. You can find this track and more over at soundcloud.com/PogoMix. His website is pogomix.net. We are lastgenpodcast.com. On Twitter, you can find this show at Diz Magic Hour Pod. That's D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. You can join our little merry band on Facebook. And if you are already there, you can add your friends. You can find that by searching for Disney Magic Hour. You can find this show on iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher. You can see pictures that we put up if you go to Disney Magic Hour Podcast on the Instagram. And we have a Patreon, which keeps the lights a-running. And if you'd like to support us and then get some cool goodies in return, you can find that at patreon.com/DisneyMagicHour. Ryan Wilson, where can everyone find you and all of the news and info and updates and history that you do over at the Main Street Gazette?
They can find it at mainstgazette.com. If you're looking for us on Twitter or Instagram, it's also mainstgazette. And if you search for the Main Street Gazette on Facebook, you'll find the page there too.
But where, oh where, dear listener, can you find Brian Bogad? Brian Bogad is here. He's back. Brian, ladies and gentlemen, Brian Bogad.
New York.
Brian, yes. Yeah.
Just anywhere in New York. I am at all times.
Nope. Even Buffalo.
Even, no. Good God, no.
Don't. I spent the year up there. There's nothing going on. Just a lot of people have said
you have to walk underground to get places because they build, when you have to build tunnels like or walkways underground, that's what hospitals do to ferry out the dead.
Well, I mean,
not to transport people.
To be fair, Magic Kingdom does the same thing.
Like I said, yes, that's it's different, but this is just like so that you can. That's to maintain the magic. The Magic Kingdom does it. Mm. Buffalo, you do it to survive. You don't need to do it to survive.
I actually had that at my school. We had tunnels. And right across, I was at University of Buffalo. And was that where I went? No. I went to Buffalo State. Don't worry about it. It was pointless anyway. I'm not a teacher. So across from us was in a derelict insane asylum. And there were tunnels that cross-connected. And, of course, there was a, you know, an urban legend as to why you couldn't get to the tunnels anymore, which I was very appreciative of at that time in my life. But, yeah, tunnels, folks. It's where we're all going. We're all going to be mole men. So with that in mind.
Or women.
Mole people, all right? Right. We're going to be mole people. So the women are coming down there with us. Despite their arguments. How's everybody's weekend? And to make this as awkward as possible, I'll answer at once.
Yay.
The weekend's going great. It's wonderful. I love it.
All right. So I'm happy everyone enjoyed that. We have a couple of guests. Adam Corbett is here, ladies and gentlemen, my partner in destiny, the game, not life. Maybe in life. We don't know yet.
Definitely.
We're feeling things out. We'll see what happens. But how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Happy to be on the show again.
I know that you're a big fan of Alien. So, look, you know, I know you wanted in. But I wanted to have you here on this one because you had shown so much love towards this movie that I couldn't find a dissenting opinion between anyone who I deemed sane. So, thanks for taking the time out on your Sunday morning for joining us and discussing the movie that we're going to discuss today. And as always, hello, Courtney.
Hello, Pete.
Welcome.
Thank you.
There is much to talk about today, and we actually have a couple of things that we're going to talk about before we get into the movie. We want to follow up. Dear Ryan, we should follow up on what we talked about last week. We celebrated the death of a man's career, I'm sure he'll do something again. As we know, Colin Trevorrow, who was set to direct Episode 9 of Star Wars, has been let go, future endeavors and all that kind of good stuff. And they kind of quickly announced the replacement. It was basically going to be one of two people. And that announcement came that it was J.J. Abrams is going to return after being the man in charge on Episode 7. He's going to take up some, the writing capabilities and the directorial job of Episode 9. How do you feel towards that, knowing that Rian Johnson was offered it and said no? He did not want to spend another 2 years of his life basically working on a single project after he had just spent 2 years working on that same single project. And which is weird because he had said so many times before that he would love to do another Star Wars film, but then turned this down. That aside, how do you feel about J.J. Abrams taking over the reins of Episode 9?
I'm good with it. He relaunched the franchise in a spectacular fashion. He's a safe choice. Like we said, there's a short list, and there were two names on it. I think Johnson not coming back is almost very much like the Daniel Craig, James Bond bit. You've done it for so long, you just want to break for a little bit. I think JJ kind of had the same thing after he did Force Awakens, and now he's right, but now I want to go back and play some more. And so it's a good choice. It's a solid choice. He's had some problems closing out story arcs. He's great with creating a myth, creating a story, and then kind of leaving it to somebody else to finish with, nary a hint as to where to go with it. And there's been some, when he has had to close it out, it's not always been, there's not 100% success rate, but they have a good idea where this is going. They're not going to, there's not going to be a lot to flounder with and screw up at this point, as long as you have somebody who knows what they're doing.
Brian, how about you? J.J. Abrams, again, as Ryan was saying, the safe bet is the right wording on that. Do you take comfort in that? Or do you kind of be like, I guess it was going to be him if it was going to be Rian? Do you feel that way at all?
I guess, yeah, like a little, I guess you get a level of comfort. I'm not as nervous now about what the final episode will be like. I think they have very clear visions for especially what they the trilogies to be, and they need people who are going to align with that vision. And it seems like they should have. You would think that they would have sussed this out before they started hiring people, but whatever. I felt it was either going to be Johnson or, Abrams for sure. I guess I know Johnson said he wanted to do another Star Wars movie. Maybe he just doesn't want to do one immediately after doing another one, further down the line, he means. But that is a lot to commit. It is a long, it's a lot of time. And I have no problems with Abrams. I mean, he'll be fine. It'll be good, I'm sure. I feel better with him doing it than them bringing somebody else, some other person in who's never, never touched a Star Wars movie before. Because even Rogue One was good, but that, there was tons of people with their hands in that, and that had a lot of issues. And the only one that hasn't had issues was the first one and the Force Awakens, and that was great. So,
yeah, I'm fine with the pick. I think it's, it's a safe pick. But it makes sense when you kind of back up and look at all the people they've had to let go. You're like, oh, okay. You kind of had to pick someone who you knew wasn't going to botch it, drop the ball, and you wouldn't have to hover over as much. Also, probably, you know, like Kathleen Kennedy probably feels that she doesn't have to hawk over that production now. I mean, not that she's not going to hawk anyway, because that is kind of her job. But I just think it makes her feel a lot more comfortable now. But it does show some pretty terrible judgment on her behalf that kind of sits in her lap. You shouldn't have to fire this many people. That no. shouldn't be a thing. Especially
anybody
when
think she was just having a like a drunken bender one particular night.
I don't
and just
I just
made a few bad picks.
I think that there was some picks determined on box office and this and that, and there wasn't a lot of thought put towards, well, what kind of movie did they make to make that money? Like, what was it? You know, especially in the, you know, when we talked about Lord and Miller, who are now returning to the Lego franchise, mind you, which is kind of indicative of like where that went, because they went back home now. When you hire somebody who got popular on a specific type of film, don't be surprised when that person comes in and brings in the things that made them money before. They're probably going to go right back to the well because that's what you hire them for. So, you know, it's a little weird. But Adam, I mean, JJ's great. I agree with Ryan that he doesn't land the jump a lot of times. And he is writing this one, co-writing it with Chris Terrio, which gets wrapped into the whole DC universe, because he's been the writer on many a DC universe, but no one remembers Dark Knight. Everyone remembers the more recent films. So does that worry you at all?
No, it doesn't worry me at all. It's a, as everybody keeps saying, it's a safe bet. And personally, I kind of like the symmetry of it. You know, JJ starting, JJ ending. I think it's a good pick overall.
Yeah, that's something that Star Wars has never done. I mean, well, except for the prequels, and that, you know, has its thing where, you know, director returns. So this is interesting. And we will see how it goes going forward. Hopefully that movie will go forth and be plentiful. Courtney, I know you don't care. Star Wars.
I'm just I don't care at all.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You're not a huge Star Wars fan, but I mean, everyone knows who J.J. Abrams is. And yeah. Almost everyone saw Force Awakens. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, does this come off as, you know, as a good pick to you? Is it something that you look at? Did you care before about Colin Trevorrow? You know, that whole situation.
I don't know that I cared too much before about Colin Trevorrow, but I know that, you know, J.J. gave me, you know, my favorite Star Wars movie for a long time. And, you know, I liked the way it looked. I know there was a lot of complaints about that. So I'm interested to see Johnson's film and then another Abrams film. I'm interested to see the difference in the look between the two films and to see how JJ wraps up the, you know, the new trilogy.
Yeah, there's going to be some big emotional, you would hope, big emotional, you know, spots in that film. And it will decide whether or not that series is successful. That's, you know, it's kind of how it is in my book. So, oh my God, everyone, please put your tired flare lens jokes to bed. The dude had like a flare lens in that whole movie. You can just stop. Stop. It's boring. It's such a boring joke. I saw one person make it. That's how boring it is. I only saw one person on the internet make a lens flare joke. So you can all put that away. Till next time, let's talk about what started this. I guess I'll talk about it just for a moment. This weekend is the first weekend of Halloween Horror Nights 27 or 2017, because they don't seem to know which one they want to go with. It says HHN. It says Halloween Horror Nights 2017 on most of the merchandise, but then some of the banners say HHN 27. That's a hashtag they're using, but then there's nothing sold in the parks with the word with the number 27 on it. Like, it's like someone made a decision somewhere along the way to get rid of the number and just use the year the way that the Super Bowl. Isn't the Super Bowl doing that now? Where, like, they don't have a number, they just have a year? Or is it that wrestling started doing that. Football got rid of the Roman numerals.
Yeah, they got rid of the Roman numerals.
That was what it was. So I just spent the last two nights there for about 6 hours at a clip, and me and Jimmy Styles were there, and I had the express pass, so we got to experience every house twice, a couple of the houses three times. And while we definitely have an idea of our list, we're going to give all the houses one more week to just sort of settle in, because we were told there was a lot of rehearsal time that was lost between the storm and them opening. You know, basically they lost the lead up week to the opening. And while I won't say it's like glaring, like, oh my God, they really didn't get to finish this, there are some parts in the scare zones in particular where you're like, there's nothing here. Like, what are they, what's supposed to be here? There are little like mini stages set up in one particular scare zone, and we haven't seen a single human being on top of them yet. Or scare actor. In short, the houses are great this year. There's two duds. I mean, for me, there's two real duds, but maybe they'll get better. And so we're just going to, we're going to give it a whole another week. And then next week we'll record a separate show. It'll be a bonus episode, and we'll talk about our thoughts on Halloween Horror Nights. But it is off and running. The most wonderful time of the year is upon us. But let's talk about movies. Let's talk about movies. That's our thing here. So this week we are in part five in our Great Movie Ride film series. This, of course, inspired by the closing of Great Movie Ride and the fact that we were stuck in the 70s of Disney, which is a trodden hellhole of average to meh movies. That's pretty much all that happens. So we found this great escape, and we made our escape into space. So previous to this, had everyone seen Alien previous to this? Anyone who didn't, let me know. I hear crickets. So everyone had seen Alien before. Okay. So we're in the more popular realm of film. I'm not saying Singing in the Rain is not popular. I'm saying a lot of people know Singing in the Rain. Not a lot of people have seen Singing in the Rain. It's sort of one of those situations. But I think that we've crossed over for this film, back into... I don't know many people who haven't seen this film. I don't know. Yeah. Brian, have you shown Kyle, your son, yet this movie? Because you should.
No, not yet. I took him to see It before I'll show him an Alien.
Oh, I thought you were saying you did bring him to see It.
I did. I took him to see It.
You did? How'd that go?
Good, surprisingly. Okay, I don't know. It was very strange.
All right,
strange, yeah, because he's normally scared of everything, but no, he loved it.
All right, we got to talk about a scene after we record.
Oh, we'll do that. Okay.
Library scene. We got to talk about that.
All right.
It's good stuff.
Okay, good, because I want to see if some... okay, yes, we'll talk.
Yes, after. Yes. Okay, Alien, folks. Alien, we're going to talk about Alien. So, of course, in the in the attraction, this is maybe the most infamous of the animatronics. I mean, let's be honest. The Ripley animatronic kind of became famously known because it doesn't sort of resemble Sigourney Weaver in the least. The look on the face is kind of weird, but...
It looks like she's swollen.
Yeah, she got a bee sting like right before, and she's like, I'm allergic. But the animatronics on the aliens looked great. I mean, those things look. I thought they looked great. Do you prefer Ryan? Do you miss the old, this is Alien? Do you miss that when they got rid of it?
Yeah, that's. I don't know what it is about that narration that just sets that tone, and you're like, oh, things are getting real now. Like things, and it was But no, I do. I miss that. I miss that section. This is one of my favorite sections of this ride. So I said it in the thread too. Like down to the siren that they use, that's straight out of the movie. Like it's such a great. Like it just gets your hair standing on end immediately.
Yeah, they've got a lot of great stuff, and they had. I guess is a way of putting it. I wonder where all that stuff is going. Where is Ripley going?
I don't know. I saw a bunch of the grading getting taken out. I mean, the week after, like they were just, but it was really funny because of all the lighting effects. You don't realize some of that grading was like bright orange and bright green, and I'm like, no, that was like maroon colored. I swear it was when I saw it last.
Walking through there, those last couple of little nights that we had for those events that the blogs put on was really, really cool to see all that stuff up close. In particular, a certain Hawaiian shirt. I don't know why, I just never noticed it before. I never noticed the dipping bird on the right hand side because it's very low to the ground near the space spacesuits. Anyways, we can talk about that for the rest of the thing, but we got to talk about Alien. So Alien clocking in at 117 minutes. There is a director's cut, which is kind of the version that's put out in front of everyone. That's 116 minutes, but guess what, Ridley Scott doesn't prefer that one. He actually prefers the theatrical. They just put director's cut on it because they got to sell things. And that was sort of how it was released, when that whole thing came up. This film was originally released on May 25th, 1979. And in the UK, it saw a later release date of September 6th of the same year. On an estimated budget of $11 million, it earned $80 million domestically, another 24 from foreign audiences, totaling nearly 105 million. That number is also sort of unknown because there are other reports that it made almost 200 million. But Fox did some fancy bookkeeping and only had to claim 100 or so million of it. So I really don't know how much money this movie earned, because it seems like they sort of hid their tracks pretty well. But this movie all starts from the story coming into play. And for the tale of that, I'm going to actually cue over to Mr. Ryan Wilson. Ryan, how did the story come about?
So we're going to go back to – we're going to talk with Dan O'Bannon and Ronald Shusett, who are the guys listed as story for this. But they've been producers. They've been directors. They've basically had every kind of credit you can think of, going with things from Heavy Metal to Total Recall to Dark Star to Return of the Living Dead. I mean, they have a pedigree here to sci-fi, fantasy, horror, like that kind of genre that is really, really great if you're looking for those kinds of things. But we're going back to right after Dark Star, and O'Bannon's in not in a great place. Like, things aren't going well. He's sleeping on friends' couches at this point, and he starts this idea for this story of these people who have taken on this alien from a former planet because they got a serious message. And he gets like the first 20 pages. He comes up with the treatment. It's like 20 pages with some of these horror elements. And according to him, it was pretty sketchy, but he remembers thinking it was one of the best things he had ever written in his entire life. And so he takes it to Shusett, and they're talking about it. And he goes, well, you also had this idea for this story of a B-17 bomber being plagued by some type of gremlin. Like, why don't you combine these two? And the minute they hit that, they're like, this is our story. This is what we want to do. And so he goes and he drafts that. And he had this whole thing, they awaken from hypersleep. There's this odd transmission. And he started telling the story to executives. And originally they thought they were going to have to self-produce this. At least Shusett was going to have to produce it. And then they kind of start getting some interest. Eventually Fox comes around. And while one of them were going to plan on directing, they said, we think we need maybe someone else. And so they tap Ridley Scott, who's relatively unknown at this time. He's only had one movie prior to this. He's been known for commercials mostly. But he comes in, and they expect that he wants to change everything. And he goes, I don't want to change a single thing on this story. He goes home to England, and in 3 weeks, storyboards, I mean, moment by moment, the entire film.
Yeah, storyboards a whole film, brings it back to Fox as a presentation, and not only does it win him the job, they double the budget based on his pitch, which is kind of amazing because, he was coming off only a single film, which was his premiere, which was 77's The Duelists. And for him... according to a quote from him in a book called The Visualist, Direction and Design, this is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre of science fiction, which makes sense when you watch it. It makes even more sense when you hear about his original ending, which we'll get into in just a moment. Just kind of hopping back to Dan O'Bannon, though, it was funny. I loved how you brought up the idea of, hey, we had this idea for this gremlin, messing around with a B-17 bomber. And many people are going to say, well, they just kind of stole that from Twilight Zone, didn't they? Yeah.
Yes.
And the man, Dan O'Bannon, is not shy about admitting it. His quote was, I didn't steal Alien from anybody. I stole it from everybody. Forbidden Planet is where the whole sequence of a ship being warned not to land was inspired. Planet of the Vampires is where a giant alien skeleton is discovered. And there's even a short story called Junkyard that has a scene in it where a space crew lands and there's a host of eggs, like just sitting in a, you know, like a chamber sort of setting. Yeah. And then, you know, you have the Twilight Zone thing also. So, look, everything comes from somewhere. Not everyone's willing to admit it. This guy was totally okay with it. And whatever it was towards that, you know, it was also totally okay with Ridley Scott because, as you said, he loved it. And, you know, when he came on to do it, he was not the first choice. Or I should say, he wasn't the first approached. There were three other gentlemen who were approached before this. And I'm going to tell you what they did, their names and what they did. Peter Yates, who was primarily known as directing the Saint TV show, seems like an odd match. Jack Clayton, who will come up later on this show because he directed Something Wicked This Way Comes, and The Great Gatsby. That seems a little like, okay, you know, at least I can see the idea, you know, sort of working over there. And then Robert Aldrich was also approached about it, and he directed Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. You know, I'm writing a letter to Daddy. It's terrifying, the movie. And Dirty Dozen. But the production team over at Brandywine, which was now, you know, they were kind of co-financing it and, you know, working in between with O'Bannon and stuff, they were all worried that none of those cats would treat this as a real film and treat it as a B film. You know, kind of have like that goofy sensibility to it. But then Ridley Scott comes in and he's like, no, it's as serious as death. Like, you know, so I don't know, like a young Ridley Scott reading this and being like, yes, it's murder. Like, I just love that idea that he just said that. He probably had his eyebrow up, you know, while reading it. It's just great stuff. So he's brought on, but then really kind of the biggest part, and I'm going to preface this. We could talk about this next gentleman for a week and not get into all the history of his life. H.R. Giger is one of the most fascinating, strange people of the universe. And he was a surrealist painter from Switzerland. And he is the visual idea behind the entire Alien franchise. And it all starts with Necronom number 4, painting that he did, which is the basis of the Alien. If you want to look it up online, Necronom, it's got that, you know, the elongated head and all of that. And Ridley Scott, a quote from him was, down the line, I realized it made a lot of sense for Giger to design everything that was to do with the Alien. That includes the landscape and the spacecraft. So basically Giger, initially was, you know, the inspiration. He became the lead designer, basically the art designer for the entire film. And then the movie really became about his monster, you know, in so many ways. So again, it's a really long road you can go down with that one, but we're going to continue just sort of talking about this film in particular and just moving on. So we have our director, we have our, you know, production team. Fox steps in, you know, they have the money, they have tons of money off of Ridley Scott's pitch. They give them even more money, which is sort of unheard of. And trust me, never going to happen again when a young director is like, hey, I need twice the amount of money to tell my Alien story. Probably not going to happen a lot in the modern Hollywood system. But now I got to get our cast. And our cast, you know, on this show, we've always done like a lot of people in the cast. And then we recently were like, you know, we should just do the main cast. And then we got a movie where almost everyone is the main cast. So we're going to start from the top of the chain and just sort of work our way down as if the ship were away, except for one guy. Tom Skerritt is Dallas. Tom Skerritt, also known, I think most people are going to say Top Gun. I don't know. I remember him the most from Contact because Top Gun is Top Gun. Also, Steel Magnolias, a river runs through it. But the largest part of his acting career was him making Picket Fences, which also got him nominated for a Golden Globe in 94 and 95. And he was nominated there for Best Performance by an Actor in a TV Series or Drama. He kind of, you know, had his own thing going in that one. Of course, in the non-lead role, which is a good trick that this movie plays, Sigourney Weaver is Ripley. She would go on to be in basically everything that happens going forward with the Alien franchise. Avatar, of course, The Highest of the Mountain, Ghostbusters, Working Girl, Gorillas in the Mist, Galaxy Quest, which legitimately I think is like her best movie. She was nominated for Best Actress in 1989 for Gorillas in the Mist, and she was also nominated in 1987 for Aliens. She got nominated for Best Actress for that movie, everyone. I feel like a lot of people don't recognize that. Remember that. But also in 1989, she got a Best Supporting Actress nod for Working Girls. She was nominated twice in 1 year. She didn't win. She's never won an Oscar, which is – I thought she won for Working Girl, honestly, when I was doing this. I was like, I thought she won. Veronica Cartwright stars as Lambert, everyone's favorite screamer. She screams a lot. She was in The Birds when she was younger. She was also in The Witches of Eastwick with Jack Nicholson and the whole crew. Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the one from the 70s. She also lent her voice to the video game Fallout 4, which I found fun to find out. And then she has a ton of TV work, X-Files, L.A. Law, Invasion, Resurrection, Bosch, you know, a little more recent. She actually won Saturn Awards for her performance in Alien and Witches of Eastwick, and she's also been nominated for 3 Emmys with X-Files and ER. So she's been everywhere. Next two folks, when I originally made this list, one of them was a big thing because we lost him recently. And then a couple of days ago, we lost Harry Dean Stanton, who plays Brett in this film. Harry Dean Stanton might be one of the most recognizable people that a lot of people don't know, but they know. He's just a class act, top-notch character actor who just made a hell of a career playing every conceivable role. You may remember him from Green Mile, Paris, Texas. If you've never seen it, you should see it. All you Twin Peaks fans, I know that that's the top of the list over there. Repo Man, Wild at Heart, Pretty in Pink, Christine, Escape from New York. And actually, a lot of you may recognize him in a bit part from The Avengers. If you remember when the Hulk came crashing through the building, when the Avengers all kind of scattered and went into a bad place, and the Hulk is pantless. There's a custodian there, a janitor, and that's Harry Dean Stanton. And why is he there? Because Joss Whedon is a massive Harry Dean Stanton fan, and he just wanted to get him in the damn movie. So we just lost him this week. Very sad, but he was also 91. He lived a hell of a life. So up next is another legend in the acting world. Man, there's a lot of people in this film. John Hurt plays Kane, and John Hurt, I'll just name some because, again, you would know him best, Ollivander, as Harry Potter. I think that would be the biggest touchstone for most people. He was in Hellboy, one of my favorites. Elephant Man, Midnight Express, 1984, The Field, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, and recently appeared in Jackie with Natalie Portman as a priest, if I remember correctly, which he also was in another film with Natalie Portman, V for Vendetta. One of my favorite films of all time, The Proposition. It's an Australian Western, which you should absolutely watch. And he was the War Doctor in Doctor Who. He was nominated for Best Actor twice for his work on Elephant Man and Midnight Express. Again, legendary, legend, legend, legend. Speaking of legendary character actors, coming up next, Ian Holm is Ash. He is Bilbo. Bilbo in Lord of the Rings. You would also recognize his voice as Skinner in Ratatouille. He's in The Fifth Element, The Homecoming, From Hell, Naked Lunch, Brazil, The Madness of King George, Chariots of Fire, and even Garden State, because he played a pretty good father role in that. He was actually only nominated once for an Oscar for his supporting role in Chariots of Fire, but he has won well over 20 other awards for numerous roles from various sources. Yaphet Kotto plays Parker, whose name probably gets yelled the most in this film. Usually being yelled at him in an aggravated way from Sigourney Weaver. Yaphet Kotto, you hopefully have seen Live and Let Die in your career. And as, of course, he's in Live and Let Die. Running Man, remember? He was Arnold Schwarzenegger's friend, you know? Planes, Zero, that whole movie. It's amazing. Midnight Run, he is Mosley. That is where I first saw the man. It was Midnight Run. Love You to Death, Roots, Othello. He was nominated for an Emmy on his work on Raid on the Enteb. I'm probably saying that wrong. Supporting actor in a comedy or drama at the time. And finally, well, there's two other people, but visually, sort of, appearing is Bolaji Badejo. And he is the alien. So a little bit of a story behind this. The casting agent, Peter Arden, was in a pub in London. And at this time, they were looking for somebody to play the alien. Peter Mayhew was actually considered. Chewbacca was considered. But he's not quite right because Peter Mayhew is kind of big. You know, like he's not a praying. Yeah, Brian, what were you saying?
No, I'm saying he's not like thin. Like he's broad shouldered and yeah. Like, you know, he's a tall and big guy. He's not tall and thin.
Yeah, they were looking for like Manute Bol to give it, yeah. You know, like a modern. Is that a modern day reference? I don't even know if that's a modern day reference.
Yeah, I don't know anymore. For us, it is, but for nobody else, probably.
They were looking.
Slenderman.
Slenderman. Perfect. Yes, Doug Jones. Doug Jones should be an alien. He should play Alien one day if it wasn't all CG and stuff like that. That would be a good idea. They were looking for someone who could do a, quote, praying mantis approach. So this he sees the 6 foot man, 6 foot ten man enter the bar, very lean, long arms, and approached him and set up a meeting for Ridley Scott, which upon seeing him, Ridley Scott was like, yes, that's it. So towards the final outfit that they use, it was largely designed by Giger, and basically, surprise, surprise, the actor could barely breathe in the get-up, and he could barely see anything, which is sort of a thing that happens whenever you see good makeup. Just assume that the actor is miserable in it. But he was this guy, Bolaji. I feel like Bolaji sounds better. A very, very quiet person, did minimum amount of interviews following this with all his success, all his, you know, fame then from being this, you know, the creature of the alien. But he just basically kind of, after the film, quietly went on to start his own art gallery and then passed at the very young age of 89 from sickle cell anemia. But one of the few quotes when he did give an interview was, when I was in a station, I could barely see what was going on around me except when I was in a stationary position while they were filming. There were a few holes I could look through. It was terribly hot. I could only have it on for about 15, 20 minutes at a time. When I took it off, my head would be soaked. They also, for the mouth with the, you know, the drool and stuff, that's actually like a ton of KY jelly. So he said there were a lot of funny stories about them having to go buy stuff and then just seeming like a bunch of creepy people. finally, we have Helen Horton, who is Mother, just the voice of Mother. She was in Superman 3. That's really the reason why I had to bring that up. Also, Benny Hill Show, Dick Emmerich Show, tons of television. But yes, the voice of Mother. Yeah, so that is our cast. And just, you know, I want to give you a quote from Roger Ebert because he pointed something out that I didn't even realize at first. So this is straight from Roger Ebert, who I enjoy quoting, evidently. None of them were particularly young. Tom Skerritt, the captain, was 46. Hurt was 39, but looked older, as he always did his whole career. Holm was 48. Harry Dean Stanton was 53. Yaphet Kotto, 42. Only Veronica Cartwright at 30 and Weaver at 29 were in the age range of the usual thriller cast. Many recent action pictures have improbably young actors cast in these key roles or sidekicks, but by skewing older, Alien achieves a certain texture without even making a point of it. These are not adventurers, but workers hired by a company to return 20 million tons of ore to Earth. But they would not be doing so unless they did it to some jaunty tunes. So, Courtney, we have our cast in place. We have our production company. We now need, you know, classically, we need some music. So what happened towards the music of this film?
Well, we have another great composer and a great score this week by Jerry Goldsmith. And he's an American composer who was well known for his use of experimentalism in his compositions. That was things like just keying notes on an instrument without blowing into the horn, you know, using electronic sounds, things like that.
Cool.
Yeah, Jerry Goldsmith started out composing for radio shows and then TV shows. Some of those shows are The Twilight Zone, which we just talked about, Thriller, Wagon Train, which we've talked about for the last 2 weeks, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and The Waltons. He did all of the music for The Waltons. And then his first major film score was for Lonely Are the Brave. And throughout his career, he received 17 Oscar nominations, but only won once for The Omen in 1977.
Oh, wow.
And he didn't think he'd even be considered. He'd already been nominated a ton of times. and hadn't won. And he thought, well, it's a horror movie. I'm not going to be nominated at all. And then he ended up winning that year.
Huh.
His other notable scores include Planet of the Apes, Patton, Chinatown, Logan's Run, Star Trek, the motion picture, as well as many other Star Trek shows and movies. Poltergeist 1 and 2, The Secret of Nim, which was his first animated film. Gremlins 1 and 2, Total Recall, Basic Instinct, L.A. Confidential, and a ton more. And a couple fun things, and then one not so fun thing here. We're going to have to end this one on a downer. He did some stuff for Disney. So he wrote the score for Mulan and conducted the score for Mulan. And he also wrote the music for Soarin' Over California. So that score that we love so much, arguably the best ride score in all of Disney, he wrote. And it is said that when he went on his first ride on Soarin', he came down in tears because he was so moved by it. He'd always loved flying and he'd loved music, and it just combined the two things that he loved the most. And then the score was redone again, heavily influenced by his original score for the new Soarin' Around the World attraction as well.
Yeah.
Here's another fun thing, too. He also wrote the Universal Pictures logo theme that is still used.
Yeah, that's so cool. And it's crazy because it like fills up his, it makes even so many more credits on his IMDb, because it's like whenever that theme is slightly tweaked, like it gets like a credit. So it's like Scott Pilgrim, you know, it's like,
yeah,
like,
and I love that one.
Yeah, that's a fun one.
Yeah. And then last, before we move on here, his original score for the film was considered to be too lush by the director and the editor. So he rewrote the score, and it turned out that the editor ended up using pieces from a score previously called Freud that he had written much earlier in his career. Those pieces were used in the film, as well as a piece called Symphony No. 2 Romantic by Howard Hanson for the end credits. So they ended up just chopping up all of his music for this film. Yeah. And it was something that he always kind of resented for the rest of his life.
Yeah, Ridley Scott doesn't, he gets what he wants.
Yeah.
Even at that time where he didn't have a lot of power, this is where he kind of earned all of that. But yeah, the music is very subdued in this film.
Yeah.
But that's what's up. And then you want to go to the last part? I know you... On Jerry Goldsmith. I mean, he did. He passed.
Yeah, he passed in 2004.
But wow, what a ridiculous career. What an insane career. My God. Just looking at the list of nominations for all the music that he did is just out of this world. So even though, I mean, this film could have no music. I mean, it does work. I love what I can hear. But they never put the music to the forefront, like ever.
I think the only time that I really noticed it was you have that shot of the Nostromo headed toward the planet, I believe. Okay. And there's a big pretty swell there, but that's the only time that I really ever was like, hey, this is great music.
All right, so you know what? I'm going to give you guys the quick plot synopsis of this film, and then we're going to start talking about it. Let's talk about the plot. All right. So, for those of you who haven't ever seen this film, I guess spoilers? I don't know, it's weird, but that's for everything that we ever talk about. So, the crew of the Nostromo awake from a hypersleep, and they all assume they have reached their final destination. They're a mining company, time to go to work. One issue, though, this is not their system. Ripley, the ship's warrant officer, makes a point quite confidently about this a number of times, saying, this is not our system. Turns out that the ship's computer, which is named Mother, it's not really an AI. We don't have an evil AI in here. Mother picked up a strange signal from a nearby planet, which is cataloged as LV-426, and the crew of seven are meant to investigate the signal since it is part of their contract. Three members of the crew, Dallas, the captain, Lambert, the navigator, and Kane, the XO, suit up and investigate the poor land, following a poor landing on the planet. The ship actually gets a fair amount of damage. They're going to be stuck there for about, what did they say, 25 hours? 25 hours. Probably 17, but they tell them 25 anyway. And the repairs are going to be done by the ship's engineers, Parker and Brett. And then still also in the ship, Ripley and Ash, who's the ship's science officer, they're going to monitor the three explorers as they go off onto this new planet surface. While making their way to the signal, they discover a crashed spaceship, unknown to them, so unknown to human. And within the craft, they find a large pilot, a jockey of space, one may say, sitting in a large chair that looks like a cannon, but the cannon of Alien will later change what the hell that whole thing is. The real interesting thing, though, about him is that, or him, or her, or whatever it is, space person, is that their chest seems to have exploded from the inside out. As the three people go further into the ship, communication is lost. And Kane, again, the XO of the ship, sees they all sort of look in a different way. And Kane finds a chamber filled with what he even calls eggs. Kind of look like eggs. And as he gets a closer look, one of the eggs opens up, a creature attacks him, and we cut away. Dallas and Lambert bring Kane back to the Nostromo, but Ripley is not ready to open this door. Quarantine rules. Got some standards. Quarantine. Ash is like, no, we're going to let him in. Opens the door, just disregards her completely. Let in the door, and we find that Kane has this thing wrapped around his face. It is hugging his face, evidently. And it's even wrapped around his neck. And whenever you try to remove this creature, it begins to choke him. And not good. So maybe we're gonna try to cut it off. All right? Kane says, Dallas says, well, we got to cut it off, as Tom Skerritt would say. And no good, because guess what? Surprise, surprise. There's acid for blood, and it almost tears through the entire ship. Not good. It's okay, though. Totally okay. Because a little while later, facehugger thing has left Kane. Kane wakes up. He seems fine. A bit tired. All he remembers is the feeling of being smothered. The crew preps up and says, you know what? We're going home. We're going back into cryosleep. We're going to take the ship back. But first, let's have some food. At dinner, things go badly and Kane starts to convulse. A creature, maybe an alien, breaks out of his chest and skitters off as the crew is stunned at the scene. We will talk about that in a moment because guess what? The crew really was stunned at this scene. Because none of them knew what was supposed to happen. Veronica Cartwright, in particular, had no idea that she was going to get sprayed in the face with blood. Her scream is 100% authentic in the movie because she didn't know what was going on. They attempt to capture this little creature with cattle prods and nets. They even have a little tracking device, but all that tracking device winds up doing is leading Ripley, Brett, and Parker to find Ripley's cat, who is a miserable thing that basically gets a man killed. So Brett lets the cat go and is told to track it down so they don't keep following the stupid cat. And as he does, he is set upon, hunted by a now giant grown xenomorph, an alien, and complete with a double set of jaws, kills him. They decide, hey, we've got to do something about this because we're all going to get murdered. And Dallas figures out, how about we'll trick him, this alien, we'll get him into the airlock, punch him into space, and we'll be fine. But to do that, we got to set up all our tunnels to force him in that direction. Well, doesn't work out very well. In trying to do that, Dallas gets killed. Now only four crew members remain. We got Ripley, Lambert, Parker, and Ash. Lambert's ready to jump ship, literally, and just like leave the ship, get on the little safe shuttle. But Ripley points out, can't put four people on there. We can only put three. We got to still get rid of this alien. We have one too many people also. So maybe just by time we'll wind up with three anyways. Ripley is now in full charge, and she goes to the computer. She's like, hey, what are we doing out here? Because something doesn't seem right. Well, nothing is right. Because she starts to look into it, and it turns out that the mission is not really what they think the mission is. The mission is to go and get one of these aliens. Upon learning this little bit of idea, Ash sort of pops up. And Ash has the whole time been a little weird. He actually starts to attack Ripley, begins to choke her with a magazine, which is awkward, to put it mildly. And then Parker and Lambert actually come to her aid and smash Ash in the head with a fire extinguisher, which you would think would kill him. Surprise, surprise, he is a replicant. Or an android. Whatever you want to call it at this point, because I think it can go with both. They reanimate Ash's head in a great scene, and verify that the ultimate mission was to get this xenomorph. They've all been duped. Their company set them up. They are just there as fodder. You know, to whatever has to happen, they got to get this. So Ripley's like, all right, well, I got a better idea. We're going to blow up this whole ship because guess what? We're down to our magical three people. Lambert and Parker go to get supplies, though, and surprise, surprise, they are murdered by Hellion or by the alien. and only Ripley remains. She makes it to the support ship, takes off in a very 2001-y way, then watches the Nostromo blow up upon itself, but she's safe. But unfortunately, there are two passengers in her little support ship, as the alien has nestled itself quite comfortably into the alcoves of the ship. She sees this in a terrified way, slowly makes her way into a spaceship, hits the eject button, and the poor alien is sucked out into space. Off Ripley goes back home if anyone finds her. And we do know that someone will find her. Paul Reiser, basically. Many years later. 10 years later? Almost 10 years later. Paul Reiser will find her floating in space. And that is Alien in the quickest way possible. So let's talk about Alien, folks. Brian Bogad.
Yes.
Alien. From start to finish, do you think this is a complete film? You know, I mean, we went over the story quite quickly. And it cuts in at 2 hours, and it really, it sort of never stops. It never feels forced or rushed, but I don't think it ever stops either. Did you have a similar reaction to it, or, you know, what was your reaction to this?
Yeah, no, it's one of those movies where it's 2 hours, but you don't realize it does. It's constantly moving. I mean, just even the beginning when they're just all talking and sitting around and stuff, it's the dialogue is great, the interactions between the crew is great, and then once they really start to see what's happening and stuff, it's just like kind of, you know, picks up and it's nonstop from there. The whole movie, it's paced beautifully, it's engaging from start to finish. And I think it's a complete movie. It doesn't have a down moment for me at all, really.
Ryan, I was talking about when I was, you know, doing the whole run through with the chest burst scene, arguably one of the most iconic scenes in film, something that's been parodied a number of times. Of course, most people will know it from Spaceballs. There's a great parody of that scene in there, complete with an appearance of John Hurt and all that. But I was unaware that they did that in a shot in one take. That was four cameras set up like that. And then, you know, we were saying how, like, you know, Veronica Cartwright legitimately, like, freaked out.
Yeah, I mean, you could see that. And it wasn't just in this scene. Yes, in this scene, it was the highlight of, you know, that moment. But Scott regularly would keep cast away from the alien because he did not want them to see any of it. They would do their scenes, and he wanted all the reactions to be as genuine as they could. So they would work up to a setup, and then they would walk the actors off. They'd bring in the xenomorph, and then they'd walk them back on, and then expose the creature to them in a way that you got these visceral reactions to things. And so it's that psychological part to this movie where it's, you know, not only was he doing that for the audience, he was doing it for his cast as well, you know, and playing to this idea that, you know, he wanted this to be just a completely horrifying experience for anybody who's coming within this movie with a 10-foot pole.
And he did that. He did more of that psychological playing when it came to Yaphet Kotto and Sigourney Weaver. He actually asked Yaphet Kotto, he told him, to annoy Weaver off camera so that tension between them would be more realistic. And then Kotto later would say, like, he really regretted doing that because even though it works for the movie, like, he was kind of a dick and he really liked Sigourney Weaver, but he couldn't act like that. Adam, do you think that, you know, did it work for you, the interactions with the crew, that tension that they felt, you know, specifically between, you know, Sigourney Weaver and Parker and Ridley, and then Parker and Lambert? I mean, they just seem like they want to kill each other pretty much all the time. So, you know, did those interactions seem genuine to you?
They seem very like a real crew that have worked together, that have a history. They seem to really feed off each other very well as far as acting standpoint goes. And I felt, to me, like if you can elicit that kind of response and you're like, oh, yeah, you know, I've worked with somebody like that kind of thing. And yeah. You really get that feeling that these people have been together a long time and know each other almost on an intimate level. And I think they even there was a band in Story Point where they were kind of having like casual relationships, and I think they brought that back to Prometheus.
Yeah.
And yeah. So I think you could feel it, and especially if you can get through a 2-hour movie and know everybody's name and, you know, kind of have a little bit of history, then I think you did a great job.
Yeah, they do a really good job of establishing the crew. But according to one of the little tricks that I love that they pull in this film is, you know, normally when you watch a movie, the person that you're introduced to near the beginning or whatnot is the person that you're going to be following, you know, as the film goes on. In this film, we open with John Hurt. And Sigourney Weaver's character of Ripley, which obviously we have to speak about because she becomes, you know, a film icon. But she's not in the forefront for 85% of this movie. You know, she is in the background, always involved, but not at the forefront. You would think it's going to be Tom Skerritt's, you know, Dallas, who's going to be our hero, you know, or something like that. And we're first introduced to that. Did you enjoy that sort of bait and switch that the film does, you know, knowing full well that Ripley is the hero?
Yeah, I did. I didn't remember all of the details so well. So seeing it again after a while, it was interesting to see the relationships. And like you said, you know, with John Hurt, you know, being the first person we're introduced to and then subsequently the first person that we lose in the film. That right there just kind of sets it on its head. And then you see the dynamic that Ripley has with Dallas, and Dallas is clearly the person in charge. He's the one, you know, he's got all the dialogue, and then we lose him as well. So, I just love the way that they did that, that, you know, it wasn't what you were expecting. And it, you know, of course, I knew that Ripley was the hero.
Yeah.
But it's not, you definitely don't see it from the beginning.
I'm thinking about it and I'm like, 1987 is Aliens. So I'm like 9 years old, right? Yeah. I'm 9 years old or so. I definitely saw Aliens before I saw Alien. So I don't know if I ever got the original intent of this movie with that bait and switch, because when I saw Alien, I already knew Ripley was a hero because I saw her shoot a million of them in the face in the previous film, you know. And then this was like mentally to go from Aliens to Alien, where Aliens has a lot of cartoonish characters, you know, like that's a very, you know, look of like of that way. Caricatures is the word I was trying to look for.
Yeah.
Where this first film, you know, is not that. Aliens, it's, you know, it's like guns and everything going off. Alien is the single, you know, all that kind of good stuff. Actually, the xenomorph in this film only has 4 minutes of screen time. Almost, not even. And he doesn't appear until an hour into the film. So he's kind of following the Jaws method here as well. But other, you know, other influences in this film are Star Wars, which is just a couple of years before. 2001. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, I don't know. I those all make sense to me. The Star Wars one I see for, like, the used technology and how, like, the ship doesn't look new. Where, like, in some sci-fi, it's all shiny. Now, funny enough, in the prequels, they would make everything shiny. But regardless, you know, in the A New Hope, everything's kind of used looking. 2001, it's the pacing. And then Texas Chainsaw Massacre is, you know, the horror aspect of it. So, you know, Ryan, to you, is this a horror film or is this a sci-fi film? Is it a sci-fi horror film? Does it really matter?
I think it does matter. And this is funny because I had this discussion in my house this week because, you know, my wife has watched this, but she kind of watches it in passing, or if I'm watching it, she'll catch it here and there. She's like, well, it's a sci-fi movie. I'm like, no, it's a horror movie first in a sci-fi setting. Mm-hmm. And that's how I've always looked at it. Is that, you know, and granted, you could take it on, and then, you know, you move on to Aliens, and now we've moved into action film realm. But this one, I think, truly is just a classic example of a horror movie done extraordinarily well.
Does anyone know of the original ending? Raise your hand. Adam, you raised it first. You win. Tell the audience the original ending of this movie.
So, the original ending, which I don't believe they filmed it.
No, they didn't.
Okay, so it kind of ends the same way with the alien stowing aboard the ship, but then rushes Ripley and pretty much decapitates her, and then kind of sits in the chair or something and kind of mimics Tom Skerritt's voice with the distress call, and And I think the executives were like, no.
Yeah, he basically murders just quick out of nowhere. Like, it would be like a shocking, like, oh my God, kills Ripley and then mimics a human voice while calling in for help, basically, you know, to have more people show up and all that kind of stuff. Brian, is there any universe where you would have wanted to see that ending?
No.
No, that's it? Just no.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would have liked to have seen it on the cut, like, or,
like a deleted scene?
Like a deleted scene, yeah, or, you know, just like an alternate ending, like, thing, just to see how they did that, but no, I think that would have, no, I just... all of a sudden, to turn the alien into this talking, like something that can mimic the voice, and I don't know. Yeah, no, I wouldn't have liked it. And then it, I don't think it would have. I don't think it would have honestly made a lot of sense with other stuff that happened in the movie to have that. I think the purpose. That would make it seem like it just wanted to stay where it was, as opposed to probably trying to spread or something like that, which I think.
Well, he is trying to trick people into coming and getting him. You know, I don't know why I keep calling it him.
But then why? Yeah, I guess. Yeah, but then if he can mimic speech, he can probably like figure out how to fly that. You know, how to fly that thing, probably.
Well, you know, something I never noticed before, and you know, Cord, I don't know if you ever noticed this before, but. I never understood the purpose behind it, I should say that. The alien has a very human-type skull in the front, but then it's elongated and all that kind of stuff. And evidently, the idea is that whatever the alien incubates, it takes on its appearance, in a sense. So that's why this particular alien looks sort of human. Is because it's incubated within a human. Now, I don't know if they've ever acknowledged that in later films or even the Alien vs. Predator franchise, but do you think that the alien is more effective because he sort of looks somewhat human? Because you can sort of look at it and see those human characteristics?
Yes and no. Because when you were just talking previously about the alien having a human voice, I was thinking, well... if the alien had a human voice, I think that would actually make it less scary because then it's something that's more easily identifiable to you. I think what makes him scary is his difference between like the unknown, the foreign. Mm-hmm. I think that's what makes him so scary. So, and I don't know that I've ever looked at the alien and been like, oh yeah, that totally looks like me. I mean, even if that's the intention, I don't know that I was ever aware that was the intention.
Okay. They've always had that kind of wrestling match with getting audiences to connect with things that are alien species, whether it be, you know, a Star Trek alien or a Star Wars alien. Basically, there's got to be a human characteristic to it for people to make some sort of connection to, or it's just not workable, you know, in any sense of that. So in this film, though, they hide that xenomorph for the majority of the film. Even though in the director's cut, you get a little bit more of a look at him. You know, you get a little bit more, but not too much. Ryan, did you ever feel that you saw too much too soon in the director's cut?
No, because you really got to know. So the first time we really see the full xenomorph in the director's cut is when he's hanging from the chains and and he's getting ready to come down. But if you don't know what it looks like, if you don't know what you're looking for, you never saw that. It wasn't there. The first thing you actually see is the tail dropping down in, you know, a few minutes later. So no, I don't think they give away too much too soon in this cut. Especially considering that if you're seeing this cut, you've probably saw the movie before and you know what you're looking for. But even then, it's you really got to be quick-eyed to catch it. I think otherwise they do a good job of giving you, you know, a bit of the face, a bit of the tail, a bit giving you pieces, and you're trying to put the puzzle together of what this looks like on yourself. And that's one of those great aspects of whatever you can imagine is generally going to be 100 times worse than whatever they can put on the screen. And so by the time you get it, you're really terrified of what you're seeing.
Yeah, and they also – Ridley Scott also plays that hand very well. This is a very, you know, film based on what does psychologically – what makes people nervous. Yeah. You know, stuff like that, the flashing lights, the beeping noises, the, you know, just chaos, you know, the fog. All these things are things that make people feel claustrophobic, nervous. He also does it, though, by training you to not trust him, which is a fun – it's a good way of doing it. There's ways that they can do this and it's bad. So a film that constantly uses jump scares, at a certain point, you're like, I got it. You know, I know exactly what's going to happen. And yeah, you may get me to react, but it's only because it's loud. You know, that's the only thing that does it. So I think that he does a great job in training you towards not being able to trust loud or quiet. When the alien, you know, drops the skin, you know, of the face hugger, okay? You know, Ripley and Kane, no, I'm sorry, well, Kane's sleeping. Ripley and Dallas and Ash are looking for it in that little, you know, containment room. Little med room, and Ripley is first scared by a loud noise, you know, and like it's like, oh, okay, got that. But then shortly after that, just like within a minute or so after that, we have that very quiet moment of just the tail, and no sound happens. Like it's not like, like none of that happens, but we get freaked out, and then we subconsciously learn whether it's loud or whether it's quiet. Something may happen. And then that puts you on edge because you don't know when it's going to happen. There's no cue. Like when you watch a movie, like I just saw Annabelle Creation a couple weeks ago. That movie is rife with stupid. I like some of it, but it's rife with stupid as far as directing because as soon as it gets quiet, you're like, okay, just cue the loud noise and let's move on. So you get bored as a viewer. You get it's very predictable. In this one, because right from the get-go, when things start going weird, you get both versions. You don't know what the hell to think. And that surprise, I think, goes a long way in this film. Adam, I want to ask you a question. Now, me and you are huge fans of the movie Blade Runner.
Yes.
Okay, so Blade Runner, of course, the first time that Harrison Ford and Ridley Scott worked together. Well, were you aware, good sir, that Harrison Ford turned down the role of Captain Dallas in this movie?
No, actually, never heard that.
He was offered it, and he turned it down. So this could have been Harrison Ford in the role of Tom Skerritt, a very young Harrison Ford. Now, remember, this is Han Solo age. You know, this is right there. This is, what, a year or 2 years? 77, this is 78, 79 it was filmed in. So this is, you know, hot off the heels of Star Wars. Can you see Harrison Ford in the role of Dallas?
Oh, geez. I don't know. That's a tough one. I think Skerritt is perfect.
Yeah, he's kind of cool. He's kind of cool in his role. Isn't Tom Skerritt kind of cool in his role?
Yeah. I think he would have Harrison Ford turned it down mostly because of Han Solo, you know, two space films.
Yeah.
I would assume.
I think it would have been a little weird Captain. But I do think that he kind of has like that under, because Tom Skerritt never acts like the ship's on fire. He's very controlled, you know, management. And I think he would have done well with that. But then I think it undoes the work that, you know, Roger Ebert pointed out, where this looks like a crew that's been around for 10 years, like messing with each other, you know? They've put in some really hard time together. So I don't know. Does anyone feel that that would have been, would anyone have rather seen Harrison Ford here? Anyone?
No.
Yeah, no. Tom Skerritt's just like, he's just good. Isn't he just good?
Yeah.
So is there anything in this movie that doesn't work? Is there anything in this movie that doesn't work? Because this is traditionally a film that is highly touted. Highly touted. Is there anyone you want to give a raise of a hand of something that, okay, Adam, what do you got?
One scene that is always bothered me in this movie is towards the end when the alien is with Lambert and Parker. There's one shot, it's a second, of the alien just hopping across the screen. It just looked like somebody stuck a rubber toy and on a stick and just went right in front of the camera. And just that one scene is the only thing that bothers me about the movie.
Is that in, I wonder if that's in the theatrical.
No, that was actually in the cut we watched.
Okay, yeah, but I'm wondering if that was something added in the theatrical, and it's not in the director's cut, and it's not in the theatrical.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Because I hadn't watched the theatrical cut in forever, and honestly, when doing the research and this, learning that Ridley Scott's like, no, I like the original, makes me just want to watch that one, which is on the disc, so that's fine. But outside of that, like, single little shot, I mean, is there anything story-wise that you never felt worked? Do you? I mean, everyone wanted to kill Lambert. I know that. That was the thing. No. Like, we all wanted to kill Lambert. Courtney, did you know about the slapping sequence?
Oh, that she was told to just slap the crap out of Sigourney Weaver?
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew about that.
Yeah. What? Now, okay, so now we have a couple of instances of Ridley Scott in the shadows, like, making things work, because they did that scene a couple of times, and he didn't feel like it really worked. And then he took Veronica Cartwright aside. I was like, no, you have to slap her. And so she slaps her. And if you watch that take, which is in the film, the other three guys are like, what the hell? And it's their real reaction, because they just were not expecting that. And either was Sigourney Weaver. So all of these little mental games and all of that kind of stuff, do you think that that is vital? Or do you think that that is manipulative? I mean, it's manipulative, but is it bad manipulative or is it good manipulative? Like, how would you feel working for Ridley Scott?
I would not feel good about that. I think that there is something to surprising someone, because uh-huh. you do get a more genuine reaction to things. But I think that that's probably something that happened more then than would be acceptable now. I think that there's still a degree of that happens, but I think those stories and things like that happen more then. But yeah, no, I wouldn't be at all okay with somebody just allowing someone else to come up and slap me square in the face.
Well, that's different than that is manipulative. That is like, yeah, no, that, there's a difference between that and, like, I know for the new, like, we had talked about it, the new It movie, they really kind of sequestered Bill Skarsgård, who played Pennywise, from the kids, and, like, he didn't really see them until, you know, and they've done this with other types of movies before,
yeah,
where
the sense
they don't, till they get, you know, they don't get that reveal until, you know, because they want to kind of get their reactions to seeing it on screen and stuff like that. So that is fine for me, because that is like everyone's in on that. But just being like, you know, really shank this guy, like really do it, like that's a little that crosses a line that I think is a trust issue between the actors and the directors. That I, you know, I could, if the two actors go to each other. If I go, like, me and Pete, we're in a scene, I'm like, dude, I'm really going to punch you. And Pete's like, yeah, that's cool. Just do it. And the other actors don't know, then that's fine also for me, because those two guys have been like, okay, that's good. But just telling one person to do something and nobody else is aware of it, especially to the person it's happening to, that's a little much.
Well, you even have Sigourney Weaver. You know, poor Sigourney Weaver in this is one of her first movies, and Ridley Scott is yelling at her frequently about things that had nothing to do with her. Like, you know, the one example I know of is John Hurt had asked how he wanted him to hold his teacup, and he let that go, and later on he's yelling it at Weaver. He's like, I don't want to tell you how to hold your effing teacup. And he tells her later, he goes, I only did that because I knew you'd be okay with it. And I can't tell John Hurt that, you know, I can't yell that at John Hurt. It's like, wait a second. Like, you're directing this in the wrong person here, buddy.
But it all works. It all works, though. I mean, in the end, it all works. And yeah, you know, Courtney, you're right. This type of thing was a lot more common back in the day. But even in, you know, even in good-hearted ways, I mean, if I was to tell you that Steven Spielberg told the kids, because they shot E.T. in chronological order, which is really rare, but he wanted to do that so the kids grew a real attachment to E.T. And if I told you that he went up to them and it was like, this is the last time you're going to see E.T., you know, before the movie ends, that is why they are all like, like, because he went and told them, like, you don't have to say goodbye. because this is the last time you're going to see him. He's going away. And Drew Barrymore, young Drew Barrymore, like legitimately thought that Spaceman was leaving. So is that any better or worse than when we do a live show and I tell, you know, I tell Ryan, like, look, you're going to smack Brian in the gob, you know, during the intros. Don't even look at him in the eyes. Just go and smack him. Is there any difference in that? Is there any better or worse?
I don't know. That story just made me want to cry, though. I didn't know that. That's so sad.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't recommend that Ryan slaps Brian, though.
Yeah, well.
Well, that'd be impressive because we're quite a distance from each other.
Live show, I said. Live.
What's that behind me? Oh.
Surprise!
All right,
that'd be a real jump scare.
So that is Alien. I mean, would anyone want to talk about anything else specifically in this? You know, just towards the thing, or do you want to start getting into our three questions? Because I mean, we could talk about the film forever, but
I mean, if you haven't seen this movie, you're doing yourself a disservice by not seeing it.
So let's get to that, actually, then. Let's, you know, that's part of our three questions, and our three questions are such. And usually, by the way, Melissa is with her family. Her mother and father and sister are here this weekend, and they are currently, I think, in Epcot. I'm going to meet up with them later on. I really just want to go to Halloween Horror Nights, though. Let's be honest. So I'm gonna go again.
And you know she'll never hear this, so you know you're covered right now.
She'll probably listen to. So let's ask our questions three as they are. Does anyone remember them? I always screw it up whenever I say it out loud.
Oh, iconic shot.
Yeah, shut up, Ryan. We're gonna let the other lady handle it. Courtney, what are the three questions that we ask?
Okay, so we're going to ask if the film holds up. Mm-hmm. We're going to find out what the iconic shot of the film is. Mm. And we want to know whether it's a moral or emotional message that the film is sending.
And does it succeed in sending such a message? Let's go to the moral. Is there a moral in this film, Ryan Wilson?
Don't listen to Mother. You know, no, I don't think there is. Because of how this is set upon them, because of how this happens, I don't think there's a moral. I think emotionally it's trying to just play with every sense you have, and it succeeds on that point extremely well.
Yeah. Adam, how about you? What do you feel towards this? Does this film have a moral that it is trying to get across to its audience?
No moral, but I believe the emotion is fear, and it does it very well.
Yeah, I would say it definitely strikes a mark on that one. Brian, how about you? Is you know, don't go to space.
Don't go to space. Don't hang out with somebody after he had a face hugger on his face.
Yeah, that's a
maybe. Don't strong. Do that. That's.
So yeah. Does the film though, Courtney, without really having a central moral, if you agree with us on that, does that hurt the film or does it not matter?
I don't think it matters in this case at all. I think the visceral response that this film elicits is definitely enough to leave you with the impression that, you know, the director was intending to leave you with, I think.
This is also the age of, and I mean, I hate to bring this up because I feel like we're kind of back in that age right now. Where film was there were a number of films, Straw Dogs, I Spit on Your Grave, and a couple others that were, you know, the rape of a woman is essential part of the movie going forward. And many people have pointed to this film and saying, well, this is that, but with a man, you know, as in the way that Kane is set upon and smothered and this and that and all of that. So I don't know if they were going for a, you know, some sort of moralist, you know, moral connection there. I don't think so. I don't think the film suffers at all from having a lack of a lesson to be told, because its aim is to scare you. It is to create an atmosphere of dread, an atmosphere of claustrophobia, and there's few films in history that do it better than this, quite frankly. So I don't really think it matters. This next question is interesting. So we didn't really get into it so much, but you know, Ripley became the action female woman. You know, she becomes that. She isn't so much like the action-y star in this one, but she's the survivor, you know, and this and then Aliens kind of makes her into, you know, a proto Linda Hamilton in T2. You know, this is really what happens. But when we talk about iconic shot, normally in a film, it would include that hero. I'm not sure if that's true here, though. So, with that in mind, Brian, what is your iconic shot of the film?
For me, it's the chest busting scene with him. Just you know, to me, that's the first thing I think of, and that's the scene that's, you know, I know stuck with me when I was when I first saw the movie.
But I'm gonna give you the same jab I give Melissa on this one. Not a scene. We need a shot.
But that's what I meant, the shot. Like, with the, where it's...
Oh, when it comes out?
Yeah. Yes, yeah,
okay.
Sorry.
All right.
No, I didn't mean the whole scene. I meant the shot.
Ryan Wilson?
So, I was like you. I saw Aliens first, so my scene's always been skewed by that, and I think because of what I know, you know, past this prologue kind of a bit here, but it's always been the scene with Kane inside the egg room. It's kind of that back shot where you could just see a room full of eggs with that haze over them, and he's shining the light across the room. That shot, because of what I know that means, has always stuck with me and always terrifies me.
I like that. Okay. Adam?
I would say my iconic shot is the first close-up of the alien when it's in front of Brett and about to attack. That was just, I remember seeing that and being just blown away. That for me is the scene.
That's in the pipe, right?
No, I'm
thinking of Dallas. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah, no, in the chain room when he's hanging, but then, you know, when he comes down and then the cat comes out and then that first shot where you see him just.
Yeah, that snarl.
That's it for me.
Courtney, how about you?
Well, I have my iconic shot and an honorable mention. I'm going to go. I have an honorable mention. I get two votes because Melissa's not here.
Sure, fine.
Oh, good. Another rule breaker. That's what we do.
Y'all break rules too. It's okay. I'm going to go with Brian on this one. I'm going to go with the chest popping. I'm going to go with that as my iconic shot.
Okay.
However, I think a more visually stunning shot is when Sigourney Weaver is in the suit at the end looking out the window into space after she's launched the alien off. I think that's a beautiful shot.
That is a nice shot. And actually, it was that whole signing off bit. That was the part of that she did for Audition that got her the role.
Yeah.
Was actually that little speech at the end. For me, It is during the scene when we are discovering the eggs, when John Hurt's Kane is discovering the eggs, and it is a freeze frame of he is frame left as you're looking at it, and the egg opens up. And then the egg is opened, and you have Kane looking diagonally into it from the left of the screen. Freeze frame that's Alien for me. It all starts there. Like, that's where that film starts. You're like, what the hell is this? That is my iconic shot in a film just chock full of, you know, visual shots and this and that. And man, that tunnel sequence still makes me jump every time. That's such a great thing with the hand, Adam's mimicking it, like with the hands extended. It just looks terrifying. The movie just is terrifying, but does the movie work? Now, I want to bring up Alec Rogers. I commented this week on the page, and he was saying, and I wanted to ask all of you this. He was saying that if you have to answer this question with a but, then that means your answer is no to whether or not the film holds up. Now, I disagree with that. I respectfully disagree because I don't think that, you know, only Sith deals in absolutes. But I don't think that absolutes work when you're discussing does something hold up, because you can't account for everyone's taste. If I have to take in everyone's accountability and everyone's opinion, then nothing holds up, because I guarantee you that if I sat people in front of Kubrick's 2001, 90 of them would be bored by 20 minutes into the film. And that's just the truth of the matter. I don't think that many people would want to sit through Singing in the Rain. They'd be like, this is some hokey garbage. You know, I don't want to sit through this. That's just the reality of how people are. So I don't care, really, towards that. Everything is so subjective that you can't really worry about that. And just because I say that something works does not mean that it's perfect. You know, there's always flaws, unless you're an android, in which then you are a perfect organism. But I don't buy into that. You know, if you say but, then it's a no, because there's too many variables that come into every situation. Does anyone? No one really kind of commented on that besides me, I don't think. I was just curious of your guys' reaction to that. You know, do you think that giving something a but undoes saying that it works? I mean, that's a good question to bring up. I think he brings up a really good point. I disagree with it, but that's only me. If you have to make an excuse, in a sense, or, you know, a condition to go along with your recommendation, does it then cancel out the recommendation? Ryan, what do you think?
No, I think it's a critique. I don't think it's it's the same thing on like a job performance review. You can get a great job performance review, and they can say, but here are the things you could work on. It's not saying you're a bad employee. It's just saying everyone has, you know, no one's flawless except unless you're a replicant. But I saw this thread. I didn't comment on because you pretty much hit the points that I would have hit on. It's not that it's a no. It's more of a, I don't want to say qualifier. It's a critique. It's giving it a due. It's the due respect that it deserves in the form of, these are all great things. I think it's a wonderful movie. If I had an unlimited budget and I had a limited time, here's the things I would do. You know, I think back to when we talked about Happiest Millionaire. Those were buts, but those were heavy buts as to, there's a great 2-hour version of this movie, but it doesn't hold up. Like, that's, you know, in that sense, right, it doesn't hold up. It's all depending on where you're going with your critique.
Anyone else have a different opinion on that? I just thought it was something – I thought it was an interesting thing to bring up, and I just kind of wanted to, you know, discuss it, you know, with all of you.
Yeah. I think this. That. I feel the same way. I don't think that there's. I don't think that means it's a no, just because there's a. But there, it's art. That's all subjective. I mean, anything is, movies, music, shows, anything. Art, art related, creative related. It's subjective, and just because you add a qualifier to it doesn't mean that you're giving it a no. You know. I can recommend, you could say this is a kung fu movie. Everyone that likes kung fu movies should see. But if you don't like kung fu movies, then you probably won't like it. That doesn't mean it doesn't hold up. It just means if you don't like that type of movie, you're not going to like it. It's a good question, though. It was a really good question. Just I didn't – you like Ryan said, you hit the nail with everything pretty much, so I didn't – right back. But yeah, I don't think that means to know at all.
So then with that in mind, does Alien hold up? Courtney.
Yes, but.
Courtney, how about you go first?
Yeah, I definitely think it holds up. Just like you were saying, it's the dichotomy between loud and soft in this movie. That's to me like the most lasting thing. I feel like that's a huge influence on successful horror movies and in the future. That alone makes this hold up for me. I still jumped several times. I was still scared watching this movie, and I've seen it before. I think it's great filmmaking. I love the acting in the whole thing. I don't have any complaints.
Adam, how about you, sir?
Definitely holds up, and please, please watch this in some sort of surround sound, because that will take you to a whole other level.
Yeah. Actually, I would even say if you are able to plug in a pair of headphones into your surround system. Man, beautiful stuff. Beautiful stuff. Ryan, how about you, sir?
Yeah, it absolutely holds up. You know, and the practicalness of the effects, the way we keep everyone on edge, whether it's cast or audience, the way it's shot, it's just every piece of this is finely detailed, and it holds up absolutely.
Brian Bagad, I know you already said yes, but did you want to touch on that a little further?
Oh, no, it holds up. If you have not seen this, this is a movie that you need to see. And, I've come to realize over the past maybe like 2 years that I am very much like an atmospheric horror type of person. I am not I do appreciate my, you know, slasher films type stuff, but I like love the atmosphere. And this film is just heavy with it and dripping. And like Pete and Adam both said, if you have a surround sound system, make sure you listen to it with that or use headphones, because it's top notch.
So towards that whole question of the, you know, is there a butt or, you know, or something like that? This is, this is the first one that we've done where I'm going to say there's no butt. This is, for me, one of the most complete films ever made, and it also doesn't age itself. It's kind of timeless in its space look and all that. Like, nothing's like, oh, that kind of stuff. You know, that kind of look. The practical effect of the suit works brilliantly even now. It's underutilized now, actually, I would say. It's gorgeously shot. The actors are all on point. It's tight. It's under 2 hours. If you can't sit in this film and enjoy this, you're the problem. That's it. Like, that's like, there are some films that when you put them in front of people and they're like, oh, I can't sit through this. It's like, well, then I don't know. There's no patience. Like, there's nothing I could put in front of you that I would
the
ever
movies
feel.
Aren't for you. Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe these type of movies aren't for you. Here's, you know, Minions. But I would be hard pressed. That's right. That's right, Courtney.
I don't like Minions, for the record.
Whatever. You own
as
all
she
them.
Sits there with her Minions yeah. lining the back wall of her yeah. of her room, right?
All over the place. All over
screen screened. It's fine.
I think this movie is, as you know, as Ash describes the alien, it's a perfect organism. It really is. So if you've never seen it, we told you everything about it now. So you should have saw it before you listened to this. But yeah, Alien, one of the best ever made. And I wish that more films would look back upon this kind of a movie in doing their horror films and learn from it. And actually, I will say, I think it does a really good job in some spots.
I think I kind of have a feeling that it that's why I said over the last couple of years, like between The Witch and it, like, that's what I don't know, like it, atmospheric seems to be, even the Conjuring movies, it seems to be
might be coming
kind
back
of
a little bit,
yeah, kind of yeah. coming back that way, which I prefer for myself. So
yeah, Conjuring 2 sort of crossed the line a little bit, it's sort yeah. of, it, but I still like it, but it kind of was like, all right,
yeah,
but overall, yeah, there is an idea of it sort of coming back. We'll see how it goes in the future. So Alien, one of the best. Another film featured in the Great Movie Ride, Oh Ye Friend. And I believe actually they have a preview for the new one, Mickey and Minnie Train Adventure, whatever that's called. They have a little preview set up in what used to be One Man's Dream, whatever they're calling it now. And they also have the full model up of Toy Story Land and Star Wars and all that over there right now. So I'm going to pop over there soon and take a look at that, because I am really looking forward to the future of that attraction space. And all that's coming to Hollywood Studios. A lot of great stuff there. Did anyone want to say anything before we announce this week's winner? Or are we good to sort of go into that? Everyone good? Everyone good? All right, great. Well, with that then said, it is time for us to announce this week's winner of Giving Away KJ. Giving Away KJ, of course, features free art by Disney Master Artist Kevin John. And you should go and visit his site at kevinjohnstudio.com. He's got a lot going on over there. Legend Cove Trading Company has also launched, and has got a lot of awesome things. And, you know, we also are going to be joined by Kevin John over at Halloween Horror Nights on Monday, October 30th. And if you'd like to join us, all you have to do is get yourself down there for Universal Orlando, get yourself a ticket with Express Pass, and let me know you're joining. And that's it. Just come on by. We've got a nice crew going right now, and we're always looking for more people to join us. And at that whole event, Kevin John is going to be creating a piece of art specifically for us, for our event, that we are going to then put on T-shirts that you can purchase. And you can also buy limited edition artist proof lithographs that will only be available to people who join us on our group. And it will feature the film The Shining. And what will it feature? I'm not going to tell you, but we have our image. So Kevin John will be working on that over the next couple of weeks. And we will debut it. Actually, I'm pretty sure we want to debut on October 1st. So that's our goal right now. But this week's winner of Give It Away KJ is... Hold on 1 second. I had it here. Ah, it went away. Hold on 1 second. Tim Fisher. Tim Fisher, congratulations. You are this week's winner of Give It Away KJ. Just PM me your address for your shipping address, and I will have your art out for you by the end of next week. For last week's winner, I've already spoken with you because of the hurricane and all that. Things got delayed. You'll be getting yours as well later in this week. But how do you enter these and how do you win this? Quite simple. You go to the Last Gen page on Facebook. So that's facebook.com/lastgenpodcast. All you have to do is like and share the pinned post, which is always going to be the most recent episode of Disney Magic Hour. That's it. Then we pick from that list. Ta-da! And that's how that works. So congratulations again, Tim Fisher. Thank you so much for supporting us. Thank you for everyone for supporting us, especially those of you in the DMH production assistant page. This week's film that we are going to discuss in a live thread on someday this week, I'm not exactly sure which one, probably Thursday, is going to be none other than, is it Raiders?
It's Raiders.
Raiders of the Lost Ark. You may have heard of it. Another perfect organism, spoiler. But yeah, that's going to be this week's film. And if you're interested in joining us for these live threads, head on over to the Patreon page and become a member over there. So until next week, this episode of Disney Magic Hour has been brought to you by MEI Travel. For all your vacation planning needs or visiting Walt Disney World, taking a cruise, traveling anywhere around the globe, as Becky is right now. She is in Hong Kong, I believe, today, over at Hong Kong Disney. Visit the experts over at meitravel.com. Becky and her team get you started on your own adventure. Right now, you're listening to There You Are. You can find this track and more over at soundcloud.com/PogoMix. His website is PogoMix.net. We are LastGenPodcast.com. Find us on Twitter at DizMagicHourPod. That's D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. We have a group on Facebook, a nice active group. I think we just hit 1,800. Over at that group, so hooray until one person leaves, and then it's 17999 again, which would be weird. But get on over there if you're not a part of that already. Add your friends if you are. Disney Magic Hour. You can find this show on iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher. And of course, the Instagram is Disney Magic Hour Podcast. If you want to support this show, let us know in a way of also helping us out over our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/DisneyMagicHour. Ryan, where can everyone find the Main Street Gazette?
They can find it at mainstgazette.com. If you're looking on Instagram or Twitter, it's also mainstgazette. And if you search for Main Street Gazette, you can also find our page on Facebook.
Till next week, say goodnight, Adam.
Goodnight, Adam.
Say goodnight, Courtney.
Good night, Courtney.
Say goodnight, Ryan.
Good night, Ryan.
Say goodnight, sweet Brian.
Good night, Brian.
Good night, Pete. And say goodnight, Pogo.